I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Curzon Cinemas podcast. This week we'll be discussing the Whitney Houston documentary, Whitney, Can I Be Me? And we also have an interview with the film's director, Nick Broomfield, coming up later. I'm Sam Howlett, and this week I'm joined by two collaborators. First up, she just wants to dance with somebody. It's Jenna Hobbs.
Hi!
Second.
Where are you going? Where are you going?
I will always love him. It's Harry Chapman.
Hello, that was nice.
Thank you.
Nice. Oh, I would have said
that
anyway.
Those were nice, yeah. Actually.
Yeah.
Put
impressed.
A lot of thought into those.
Well done.
Thanks,
I
Sam.
Didn't. I thought, can I do something for myself? But I didn't.
You don't want to blow your own trumpet.
No. What could I have done? What's an untapped Whitney Houston hit that you can ram into a pun?
A bit of pre-warning.
He's Every Woman.
Yes. That's what I was looking for. Okay, so yeah, as I mentioned, we'll be discussing the Whitney Houston documentary this week, and musician documentaries are in vogue of late. So a few years ago we had the Amy Winehouse documentary Amy, which everybody loved, and also a few months ago on the podcast we talked about the Oasis documentary Supersonic. So the opening pitch for this week's episode will be: which musician would you like to see brought back to life in a documentary? We'll start with Harry Chapman, shall we?
So my musicians aren't dead. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Okay, cool. So I want to do a documentary about Chaz and Dave, everyone's favourite Cockney duo, apart from the Craze, obviously. People love the Craze. Chaz and Dave, and then the reason behind this is, so Chaz has been diagnosed with cancer last year.
I thought the way you said that, it sounded like you were making it up.
Yeah.
Harry!
Yeah.
So fact.
Fact. Chaz has cancer.
Yeah.
And so they've had to recently cancel some gigs. And so I go and chat to them and see what's going on, how that's affected them, and then look back at previous gigs they've done. Chaz and Dave done a lot of stuff. I saw them a few years ago. Very entertaining. Very entertaining. And I've come up with a title that I think will win me points with Sam. Mm. They did four FA Cup songs.
Mm-hmm.
And the title of the documentary will be called Ozzy's Dream.
Mm.
Based on that famous Tottenham player.
Ozzy. Thank you.
Yep.
Appreciate that.
Sam's a Tottenham fan. I've gone for the points. I didn't really think about how the title fits with the documentary.
Yeah.
It's all a bit dreamlike. But yeah, Chaz and Dave, great entertainment. They could talk about how Sainsbury's don't sell Rabbit anymore and how that might have affected sales of their songs and whether their song directly brought down Rabbits in Sainsbury's.
We talked about this earlier, didn't we? It's like a chicken or egg question.
What came first? You know,
did
Sainsbury's start selling less Rabbit because Chaz and Dave pointed it out and they had loads of spare Rabbit? Or did the song force Sainsbury's to stop selling?
How was the Rabbit sold? Do you know? Was it in like a slab of Rabbit?
No, I imagine it was like a chicken.
Like sort of
prepared.
Right.
But like, you know how you buy like a
chicken?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Like that.
Okay.
Am I missing something here? Is there like a famous thing that Sainsbury stopped rabbits?
Rabbit.
Listen, I know the song.
We've got more rabbit than Sainsbury's.
Oh, is that in
That's
the song?
That's one of the lines.
Oh, sorry.
Sainsbury's used to be, not that they're famous for it, but they were known for selling rabbit.
Okay. All right, you've cleared it all up for me.
I don't know when that stopped.
Yeah. Ozzy's dream, sort of looking back on their career due to illness of Chaz, how that affects Dave as well. It'll be emotional, but also a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. You can include the stuff about Only Fools and Horses as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. See, lovely.
That's a nice saga going on there.
See? Lots to delve into.
Yeah, Jenna Hobbs.
Well, listen, Harry got given the question before me, so I haven't had as long to prepare, but...
Yeah, my answer really suggested that I'd had that for a long time.
I think Harry's had about an extra 10 minutes, to be honest. So.
I used most of that looking up the FA Cup song Chaz and Dave.
So we spoke about Supersonic very briefly, and I think Oasis liked to think that they were the band of the 90s. I think Oasis are wrong. The band of the 90s, Spice Girls.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of girls my age who would agree with me.
Yeah.
And boys, actually. The Spice Girls were for everyone. I would love to see a documentary all about it. You've got the highs, you've got the lows, when Jerry left, the nation's hearts broke. And also, there's five of them. And in that, you've got Victoria falling in love with David Beckham and their secret car park trysts? Trysts?
I don't know. I never know that one.
Well, anyway.
I think tryst.
Yeah. Well, anyway,
I've said it now.
I'm sticking with Tris.
So, and then you know, you've got everything. You've got the movie. What went on there?
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of material: world tours, fragrances, dolls, the tour bus. What happened?
Would you try and just encompass everything?
Everything.
Everything.
Start to finish. No.
How long is it going to be? Is it going to be like O.J. Simpson? Is it going to be like a 10-hour documentary on Spice Girls?
Yeah, because there was a different member of Spice Girls to begin with, and they got rid of her and brought in Baby.
What was her name?
I don't know.
Oh.
But we'll find
was
it.
She, was she originally Baby, or was she like, you know, like
Game
Boy Spice?
Jerry Halliwell, I think, came up with all the names for them.
Oh.
Jerry Halliwell was a real driving force in the Spice Girls. She also came up with Girl Power, which would be the title of my documentary.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's good. I like that.
Sure. Harry's gone for, you know, the weird and wacky, but here I've chosen what the people want.
The people's champion,
the people.
Jenna Hobbs.
Yeah.
Which Spice Girl would you be, Jenna?
Now listen. Yes, the rumours are true.
Loaded question.
For about 5 years, I did make my family call me Baby Spice.
5 years. It's the first thing you said to me when I met you, Jenna. Hi, I'm Baby.
Fair, we still have to call Jenna Baby.
This week joining us on the podcast is Baby. Hi, Baby.
That's why you're not allowed to do the Baby Driver podcast.
Coming out soon. I did make people call me Baby. And still, to this day, if there was going to be like a Spice Girls dress up and I couldn't be Baby Spice, if someone else tried to take that from me, I'd be furious.
Who would you be, Sam?
I always liked Scary Spice growing up.
You've got the hair.
You've got the hair. Got the hair, yeah.
Yeah,
mm.
Yeah, so that would be me.
I...
Come on, Harry. Who are you?
Sporty?
Maybe Sporty Spice.
Maybe.
I always thought of Jake as more of a sporty, but he could be posh.
Oh, maybe I could be posh. I do like David Beckham.
Yeah. I have a question for you, Jenna.
Mm.
If you couldn't get all the members back for this documentary, would you still do it? Is it worth doing without all of them? Because I imagine there's one who definitely won't.
Do you think it's Vicky B?
I think Vicky B won't do it.
Listen, she
famously, completely removed herself.
But she did come back for the final tour, didn't she?
That's true.
Did you go to the final tour?
No, I didn't. I really wanted to tell you I didn't. I think Vicky would be on board, but if she wasn't, listen, there's plenty of footage we can get of her.
Yeah.
She and David did their own... That's the other thing. She and David did a documentary for a bit, didn't they? We could get footage from that to put into it.
Okay, so you'd still go ahead without...
I would. It would be a real shame.
Yeah.
And I think it would almost
this
be 10 like...
hour
how many,
opus.
How many members of Spice Girls would have to drop out for you to not do this? You just need Jerry Halliwell?
I think it's going anyway. As long as Emma Bunton's not there, so Jenna can be baby.
If Emma can't do it, I'll step in,
alright? It's like, where's Emma Bunton? Oh, yeah, she can make it. Yeah.
I
can join. I can join.
Meanwhile, in Jenna's flat, Emma Bunton's.
Oh, Emma, I love you.
I'm Emma now.
That's all I have to say. Taking on the Spice Girls documentary.
Sinister turn that took. Yeah. So I was going to go with Hanson, who, of course, everyone remembers. Mbop. But I just had a sudden, you know, like a, what's it called when you get a really quick idea?
A light bulb moment?
Brainwave?
One of those. Mm. That happened.
An idea?
I mean, it's got to be the London Boys.
Oh.
Now, you know me and Jake love the London Boys.
You love that for the karaoke.
Yeah. So this is a German-based English dance pop duo comprised of Eden Ephraim and Dennis Fuller. Now, they had very few hits and aren't very good. However, they have a very interesting story. They both died in the same car crash. I think this is an untapped area, the London Boys.
What would you call it? Because London Boys sounds like a quite low-budget gangster film.
It does. So it would be called the London Knights, which is the name of their best song.
Is it with a K or an N? That's what I've always wondered.
It's with an N, Harry.
It's with an N, right.
But it could be with a K because they
That sounds like a Transformers film now.
Well, they're the Knights of Pop, aren't they? That's what they're known for. They're famous for being the Knights of Pop.
Yes.
They're not. Protectors of the realm of
surely Cliff
creativity.
Richard's the Knight of Pop.
Sam, London yes, Boys, Jenna. They're quite a niche band, and London yeah. Knights is one of your favourite songs for the karaoke. I was just wondering if you could sort of do a little rendition so people know.
Well, that's the pitch. No, I'm not doing that, Jenna. When Jake's friend moved into his flat, the only thing in there from the last tenant was a vinyl of London Knights.
Yes, please.
So the person that moved out took everything, thought, oh, I can leave this.
That's all you need to know.
I imagine it glowed as they walked in. As they walked into the flat, it was just like this record glowing in the middle.
What is this? Okay, let's vote. What do we want to see? I think in terms of input and just sheer will of wanting this to happen, Jenna's got it.
I think Jenna's
thanks.
Got it.
I think
thanks,
it's the
guys.
Only one that actually will happen.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit mainstream, but whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the people will get their London Knights one day.
You probably need a tenor to make it.
It'd be about 5 minutes long, yeah. I'll just read the Wikipedia page, as I've just done now. Right, so we will be discussing Whitney, Can I Be Me later on, but first up, I had the pleasure to sit down and talk to one of the most famous documentary filmmakers of recent memory, Nick Broomfield, famous for his recent documentary, Tales of the Grim Sleeper, his Kurt Cobain documentary, Kurt and Courtney, and Big in Tupac, so many to name, so enjoy. Okay, so Nick Broomfield, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
So what was it about Whitney Houston that made you want to make this documentary about her?
Well, Whitney was the first major crossover artist, which was a black artist, mainly singing and being embraced by a white audience. And she, in a way, paved the way for people like Beyoncé. And she paid a very high price for it, which is that she was basically singing more sort of pop stuff than R&B, gospel kind of music. And, you know, she received a lot of criticism from her own community, who kind of called her Whitey Houston and things like that. And at the same time, you know, she kind of had to soldier on and sort of deal with their rejection, and also deal with kind of being something that was quite manufactured. And apparently when she was booed and called Whitey Houston, she wanted to cross back to doing more R&B kind of stuff. And her favorite phrase when she was working with her musicians was, "Can I be me?" And in fact, she said it so often when she went into the rehearsal room that they sampled it. You know, can I be me? And they would play it to her. So I just felt that was a very interesting starting point with the film.
And how did your opinion of Whitney change from before you started making the film to now, I guess, now that it's finished? How has that evolved?
I looked at a number of films that have been done immediately after she died, sort of Channel 5 kind of films. You've concentrated overwhelmingly on the drug issue and her relationship with Bobby Brown. Very judgmental pieces, very kind of news of the world, not that that exists anymore,
sure.
But very tabloid, very unsympathetic, very judgmental. And you kind of got the feeling that she was this unapproachable diva. What I found in this amazing footage that I got hold of, which is this underseen footage of about 100 hours that I managed to get with Rudy Dolitzer, is that she was a very funny person. She had a kind of amazing comedic timing, loved to laugh all the time, had this very infectious laugh, was unbelievably good company, I think. People loved her. People I interviewed just adored her. And you know, musicians loved playing with her because she never sang the same way a song. She would always improvise or do something different. And of course, they were all from gospel roots themselves, so they just loved playing with her. And so I just got the feeling that she was a great person. She would have been a great person to hang out with, and it made it much more tragic what had happened, because I think she was sort of pushed into this. I think there were so many people after her that she ended up in this very, you know, the only private space she had, in a sense, was the drugs, you know.
So is there an element of trying to not sort of change, but sort of correct the public perception of Whitney? Because she's definitely seen now, I guess, as kind of a tragic figure. Was there an element of trying to...
Well, I think she was more than being a tragic figure. She was judged for being a drug addict and kind of written off.
Okay.
And I think her contribution to the world was not really celebrated. In reality, she made so many people happy.
Yeah.
And she brought joy to so many people, and she was such an inspiration to so many singers. It's not that I consciously went out to make that film, but I felt that, in a way, when you know that, the tragedy of what happened to her at the end is even stronger.
Yeah.
But it's very, the difference is you're very moved probably to tears, rather than this very judgmental position.
Okay. So when you started to make this film, how much of a plan did you have going in? Or was it more like a kind
of... I never really have a plan.
Okay.
I just kind of gather all the material I can and then start trying to do the interviews and then learn as I go. I didn't really know much about Whitney Houston at all. I wasn't a great fan.
Mm.
I am a fan now. And I think also, you know, when I saw that footage of Rudy's of her on stage... She's really, you can see how painful it is for her to hit some of those notes, and what she's so pushing herself.
Yeah.
She's kind of like this gladiator up there, sweating and pushing it, and you just think, wow, you know, this was somebody, an amazing person.
Like, the drummer that talks about like the muscles in her back, that really shows how much of her whole body and soul she's putting into this.
Yeah, and that she had these incredible lungs, you know, and she could just, I think musicians loved her so much because they could play as loud as they wanted to, and she could still soar above them.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
So you get some amazing access to people that were close to Whitney. Was there anyone who particularly stood out to you during the interview process?
I guess I really love Patty Howard. I hope I'll have her as a friend in the future. And Kenneth Reynolds I really liked enormously, who was the guy at Arista Records, one of the guys at Arista Records, who I've become quite close to. Patty Howard, I think, was from gospel choirs like Whitney, incredibly close to Whitney. and also very Christian. So I think she and Whitney
had
very deep conversations, and she knew a lot. And was also very close to Robin Crawford, and still is very close to her. So I did feel I was sort of getting right into where Whitney's heart and soul was.
And were there any... what was the process like trying to get people to participate in this? Was it quite difficult?
It wasn't so hard. I mean, of course, it's difficult. And at the time, because the estate had sent out emails to everybody saying, don't take part, I was really worried. And, you know, it was stressful.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But then people did take part. And sometimes it's just because we got there just before the estate emails arrived. I mean, we got off, you know, we're pretty quick.
Yeah.
Someone says yes, and we're like round there in 2 hours, you know, or on the next plane.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, we'll do it next week, you know. So you have to be pretty quick off the mark. Yeah, it's stressful.
Okay. I recently rewatched Kurt and Courtney the other day, and I think there's a sort of similarity in the subject that's kind of life and death of a beloved musician,
right?
But also in Kurt and Courtney, you yourself are on screen quite a bit, and the filmmaking is very much part of that film,
right?
Could you talk about the decision to kind of stay behind the camera for Can I Be Me, and to kind of
there was just so much footage of Whitney in a very private and intimate way that hadn't been seen before, and that was incredibly revealing, not only of her, but of her relationship with Robin Crawford, her relationship with Bobby Brown, where they're like two kids together, sort of acting Ike and Tina Turner, things like that. And for a long time, I just couldn't get the film to work.
Okay.
It was a very difficult edit. And then I brought another editor on, somebody who I work with all the time, Mark Hofflin. And he said, I think what we need to do is to have Whitney take us through the film. You know, the reason the film's not working is because we're not feeling Whitney. And so we sort of put Whitney's voice into it. We tried to always examine each scene as to whether we knew emotionally where Whitney was. And there was no room, really, for me in another film.
Yeah.
And Kurt and Courtney is different in that Kurt, it's more of a film about the conspiracy theories around Kurt, whether Courtney was involved in some way or had some knowledge of his death. You know, her father, my finance being cancelled because of Courtney. All this, it's much more of a kind of gonzo film.
Yeah.
And this is much more of a kind of intimate portrait of a great...
Sure.
Of a great singer, great artist.
Okay. There's a line that Whitney says in the film, success doesn't change you, fame does. And, you know, you've dealt with the subject of celebrity a number of times before. I was just wondering, have your views on fame changed over the years that you've been making films?
No. I mean, I think she's absolutely right. You know, success is wonderful.
Yeah.
We all want to do well at what we're doing or trying to do. It's when you become famous and you can't walk down the street and everyone's calling your name and you don't know any of the people who are calling your name and you can't ever be alone. I think she was a very private person. She loved just being nippy, which is what all her friends called her. She loved slopping around in her jeans and mooching around the shopping mall and just hanging out. And I think people just did, you know, people don't, they're not badly intentioned, but I think every time someone goes up to you and asks for your autograph or asks for a selfie or asks for... It impinges on that person's ability to just carry on with their day. And I think it became just really too much with her. She didn't like it at all.
Yeah.
I mean, Bobby Brown, it's funny. Bobby Brown kind of loved it.
Yeah.
And reacted. You know, he was very incredibly sweet to people when they came up. And Whitney just couldn't... She just could not deal with it anymore.
Yeah.
I think... She retreated more and more and more.
Yeah, and people, they throw up a number of different reasons why they think what they think led to Whitney's death. It was the breakup with Bobby Brown. Someone said she'd have a broken heart. What do you think was the leading factor?
I think she did have a broken heart. I think that's much more the cause of what happened, which was she was incredibly generous, incredibly kind, supporting about 50 people,
yeah,
their entire lifestyle, and she still couldn't be herself.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And her relationships, whether it be Robin or Bobby, were so disapproved of. And I think she had a pretty kind of raw deal, really. Mm. She was giving, very disapproved of.
Yeah.
And I think it just became increasingly hard, probably to just have fun.
Yeah.
I think she was a fun-loving person more than anything. I mean, that's what you kind of get in the footage,
yeah,
of Rudy. She just loved having a good time. And I think that just too many demands on her.
Okay. So you said how the film was stressful at times. I mean, now that you're kind of well seasoned, I guess, in the documentary filmmaking world, is it getting easy? Is it easier for you to make a film now, to get a film off the running?
Oh yeah, that's obviously different from it being stressful during making it. Yeah, it's easier to get a film financed because people want to make sure that they're going to get a film back.
Yeah.
When they put the money in, they kind of need an excuse to finance you. So after you've done a few films, you're a safer bet than somebody starting out.
Okay. And what do you think about the state of documentary making at the moment? Like, do you watch documentaries in your personal time?
Yeah, I do. I do. I should watch more. I mean, I'm in the Documentary Academy division, so I'm supposed to watch
everything.
I'd probably get sent like 200-300 documentaries, and obviously you can't watch that.
Yeah.
And if you're not working, I always do try and watch, because there's some amazing films that you see.
Yeah.
And it's kind of wonderful. In the 2 years I've been doing the Whitney film, I really didn't watch many.
Sure.
But I think documentary is in a really good way. I think it's incredibly popular. In fact, I'm quite amazed, because I think, you know, when I started, documentary was kind of like a sort of disagreeable medicine that people had to take occasionally, but it wasn't regarded as fun or entertaining. I think people have learned that you can inform people in an entertaining, funny way, and you don't have to be hard on the sleeve and banging a drum all the time. And there are many different styles that have emerged that are all very successful.
Mm.
The form, the documentary form, storytelling form, has moved forward a lot and is much more interesting than it was.
Okay. And could you talk about what you've got coming up next, like your next project?
You know, I really don't know what I'm going to do next. I mean, I'm going to have the summer off.
Okay.
And start on something, hopefully, in September, you know.
Excellent. Great. Nick Broomfield, thanks for your time.
Pleasure. Pleasure.
Okay, that was Nick Broomfield there. So, let's get into the documentary. First of all, guys, I just want to ask, what were your pre-existing thoughts and opinions on Whitney Houston before you saw this documentary? Where did she sit in your mind, in your life?
I knew the voice, and I knew
how strong it was, and obviously I knew the sort of tragic ending.
Yeah.
I think everyone's aware of that. And I'd sort of heard rumblings about sort of her relationships and how fractious they were. So actually, it was almost like I had the sort of pieces, but this documentary really puts them all together and gives you a really strong idea of like where she was and actually the sort of tragic figure she ultimately is, I think.
Yeah. Jenna?
Well, I was a big fan of The Bodyguard, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because she plays a singer in that film, I'd sort of got the two stories quite confused. So I watched that when I was quite young. So I always kind of...
Were you expecting Kevin Costner just to turn up?
I was expecting him to be in the documentary. So I kind of had known her from that, known her music. Like Harry said, knew of her tumultuous relationship. But I had no idea she had a problem with drugs until her death, really.
Yeah.
It didn't seem as well publicised, like, in comparison to Amy Winehouse, who had a documentary quite recently. Everyone knew what was going on there. But for me, it was a real surprise that Whitney Houston, when she died, what had been going on in her life. And, yeah, watching this documentary, it was all a big surprise to me. I didn't know anything about her childhood, where she came from. And it was, like, really interesting to find out about.
Yeah, I think the timing of this film is interesting because so she died in 2012. Yeah, so this is quite a few years of a gap, and my main because obviously I think like Harry, I knew of a couple of songs. I knew she was a popular 80s singer. I didn't really know her for musical genius per se. But I wasn't a huge fan. But in my pre-existing memory of her and what I knew about her was that she was in a sort of slightly cheesy film. I mean, a film that Jenna loves, but that's what I knew her for that.
Looks like she's going to make
slightly cheesy.
And then had I knew about the drug problems and then her tragic death. So for me, she was a kind of figure of tragedy more than anything. And I think what this film does is actually change that. I mean, it's still a tragic end, but I think it gives her life more meaning than I had given it, I think.
Mm-hmm. I had no idea she was so successful in the 80s.
Yeah, me neither.
That she'd won so many awards and been that kind of popular.
I think she's I think the Guinness Book of Records has her as the most awarded female singer of all time.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
She is.
Which is just insane.
And Nick Broomfield said this in the interview, and it's mentioned in the film that this was before Beyonce, before Rihanna, before there were black artists really... black female artists in the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in that respect, she was definitely a pioneer.
This film has a really interesting discussion about race without being... It's not necessarily... This film isn't about race, but as in that, there's definitely a line in the film about race. And about what a black singer should or shouldn't sing and who they should and shouldn't be. And I think the film's exactly right that you wouldn't have Beyonce and people like that without it. But also... Whitney Houston singing the sort of pop songs she was singing meant that black music didn't become exclusively R&B, and they say that in the film, didn't
it?
And she wasn't, she wasn't going to be the female James Brown, and that's mentioned. I think that's really interesting that she sort of changed the view of sort of black singers and what they could and should do. And I guess the interesting thing the documentary sort of says is whether she chooses to do that or whether people sort of push her down a certain path that means she does it.
I think it was definitely alluded to that she was sort of moulded specifically and to be, to be making pop music for nothing, to coin a phrase from the film, to be too sort of like black sounding.
Yeah.
They sort of threw away certain versions of songs and things like that, and I didn't realise how much backlash she had. Was it the Soul Awards?
Yeah, she was booed.
Yeah. So not staying true to her roots and where she was from.
Yeah, race is really interesting in this film. So we took the Soul Music Awards, and she was nicknamed Whitey Houston.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so I recently watched the OJ documentary, OJ Made in America, and they talk about how OJ wasn't marketed as a black man to America; he was marketed as OJ. And even during the sort of civil rights movement, he said, "Oh, I'm not." He was asked for a comment about it, he would say, "Oh, I'm not black. I'm OJ." He kind of shied away from being a black man. And it seems like that was imposed on Whitney here, which is something I never knew. I think most people wouldn't have a clue that that was how she was presented to the world. She was presented to a white audience at a time when, in quote phrases, black music was not mainstream yet. So I think that was a really interesting part of the documentary that I didn't expect to come out of it.
Yeah, and they definitely spoke about how they sort of tried to deny her past, that she was kind of tried to become this sort of princess, this darling yeah. for the white audience.
Yeah, absolutely. So how do you think Whitney come across in the film? Because obviously it's all made with pre-existing footage. Obviously it's made after her death. Most of the footage comes from an unmade documentary about her 1999 world tour. How do you think Whitney's presented in the film?
I think, for me, she comes across... And whether it's because you know what happens and that and that fit, but she comes across so vulnerable. And every time you see her interviewed, it feels like she might cry or break down or suddenly say what's really going on in her life. And it's really interesting, every interview you see her give, particularly later on, sort of from 99 onwards, she has this nervous laugh where she's asked a difficult question and she laughs and then gives a sort of non-answer to lots of things. And I think she comes across that she loves singing and that's all she's ever known, but that she doesn't necessarily have much control over what she's doing and what her schedule is and things like that.
She comes across really quite childlike, I think, throughout most of it. And I wonder if that's because she became famous so young, because her parents were involved in her like team, they sort of ran it for her. And then she had her best friend, Robin, who was also kind of I don't want to say a parenting figure, but she definitely looked up to Robin and Robin looked after her. And then same with Bobby Brown. And so I wonder if she was never given the chance to really look after herself.
Yeah, it seems like she was constantly being told what to do, being constantly looked after. So never really got the opportunity to fully mature, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think she definitely comes across like that. She comes across incredibly nice as well at points. Like,
definitely.
There's the interview she has when she's quite young, and the guy in the interview says to her, "Oh, you won't be hearing my voice." She says, "Oh, poor thing."
That was really nice. That was really funny.
Yeah. She comes to us very sweet, very childlike at times. Let's talk about Bobby Brown then. Because there are scenes between her and Bobby Brown that come across where they're actually quite a nice couple, I think, occasionally, which surprised me because after her death, I think it was kind of seen as a bit partially he was not a nice husband, he was not a good partner.
That was certainly how it was reported. And I think what this documentary does is it shows Bobby Brown not to be the monster necessarily he's painted as, and I don't think the documentary says he's necessarily one way or the other. I think it sort of leaves that up in the air, but I think it makes you realise that there must be something for their relationship to have ever been anything. Like, they don't. It's not just that they don't get on or it's not a good relationship. There must be something there. And actually, you see them laughing together and having a joke and getting on. And I think you need to see that to understand why they're together in the first place.
I think it's obvious that she's utterly in love with him.
Yeah.
And she seems completely infatuated by him from the first glimpses that we see of them together at that birthday party. And throughout the whole 99 tour, you know, when he's on stage with her, you can tell that she absolutely adores him. But obviously, there's darker moments and darker sides to it.
It's a weird moment when they're sort of backstage and they kind of do this little role-playing thing of I can Tina Turner. And it's a slightly...
That is a weird scene.
Slightly weird moment, what they're doing. But also there's something slight kind of nice about it, that they kind of have this joke together, but also it's got a dark undertone. That's a really interesting scene that I think kind of sums up their relationship in a way.
It feels very much like... It's one of the few times where you see Bobby Brown on camera and it doesn't feel like he's playing up to the camera. It feels like he's playing with her, like, and they're having fun together. Often when you see Bobby Brown and he knows there's a camera there, it feels like
performing.
He switches something on and he's performing and suddenly becomes something different. And so actually that's a night... That feels like a private moment. Mm. It doesn't feel like a recorded moment. And I think that's why that scene feels slightly different, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. And the backstage stuff is really revealing. And there's a scene where she says, "Oh, let's just watch a girly film tonight." And they talk about how Whitney eats all the food.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of nice moments like this in the film. And I think you wouldn't get that with because Nick Broomfield's previous films have been occasionally been more investigative. mm-hmm. where you sort of follow, watch him go around sort of Gonzo journalist style investigating something like the Kurt and Courtney documentary is sort of following him asking people about Kurt's death. But this is almost pretty much entirely made with archive footage in the same way that Amy was. So it's really trying to just paint a kind of non-biased picture of someone who we can't know anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is nice to sort of just let the footage speak for itself and to take what you get from that.
Yeah.
I think it has a lot of the 1999 tour, and I think that's probably one of the pivotal moments in where she started to not be in such control of her life. And I think it would have been nice, and I know, you know, you can't magic up footage if it's not there, but to have seen what came after that a little more.
I agree. And I think it spends... Because the 1999 tour is kind of the axis of the film that everything pivots around. But it would have been nicer maybe to spend more time away from the 1999 tour.
And to see the aftermath.
Yeah, because we see glimpses, but I don't think we see enough. Because the film starts with Whitney's death.
Mm.
And that, to me, that makes me think that the film is kind of about, okay, we're now going to tell you sort of what happened to lead up to the death. And I feel like once the 99 tour finishes, there should be maybe more between that and her death. I mean, obviously, you're right, they can't magic up footage.
I think that's the interesting thing, though. I think the 99 tour has all that footage. And actually, because she steps away from the limelight, and then she had a brief sort of comeback sort of late on in her career, but because you can't magic up that footage, actually, what would you show?
And
actually, there's sort of some home videos of her at home, and where you suddenly see her, she suddenly looks a lot older and suddenly looks a lot weaker, and like all that sort of star is taken away from her.
Yeah, so maybe that's enough.
And I think that's why. And also, don't forget she is a singer, and that you want to see her sing. And some of the most powerful moments in the film, when it... the scene very early on where she's singing and the band are talking about how physical she is on stage.
Yeah, they talk about the back muscles, don't they? Yeah.
Things like that. I think that's what makes a documentary. I think it's her singing and then her tragic story against that. I think sort of the after bit would be great, but then you don't get the voice and you don't really get the insight.
Yeah, I agree. And also I think that members of Whitney's family and other people close to her didn't want to be a part of the documentary and didn't want to talk.
Very much against it.
And I think that this film would have been worse off if we would have seen the kind of more investigative element of him trying to make them talk, because I think then it becomes more of an aggressive film, and that's not what this is.
Yeah.
It's a kind, open and kind of interpretive
film.
It
is, yeah. And I think the title is actually really nice, because before I saw it, I thought that's a sort of strange title, but I think it's absolutely perfect. Another figure that I found really fascinating was Robin Crawford, who I had no idea anything about her. And she seems so important to this story. The fact that she's not there, I think, says a lot about how hard that whole tour was, that she's completely stepped away.
But it's not just the tour either. It's
everything.
That's a whole life. That's a whole life based around one person.
Yeah.
And then to have to be away from that must be... You know, you must not want to relive those sort of memories or be brought back into it. And I think this film as well is a critique of the media and how it attacks people. And there's a big thing about her sexuality and therefore Whitney's sexuality. And that is a real, sticking point. And that is a real way of, one of the people says, 99.9% of the people writing are white and 99.9% of them are men, and therefore... If someone's gay, they have a problem with that, and that is a real issue, and that seems to be they seem to get over that, and then another issue comes up, and then it's the issue of Bobby Brown and their relationship, and they're being three in a two person relationship, and I think Robin's really fascinating to see her on video, because she doesn't want the limelight. At no point when she's being filmed, I said earlier that Bobby Brown wants to, when the camera's on, he sort of plays up to it. She doesn't do that at all. All her concern is about Whitney.
Yeah, and the thing is that, there's all types of love in the world, and we don't need to speculate on what kind of love Whitney and Robin had, but it definitely was there, and it was very deep, and they'd known each other for a very long time, and Robin obviously cared so much about Whitney, and to know that Robin had to step away because of how destructive Whitney's life was becoming and that she felt she couldn't do any more, says a lot as to what happened post 1999, I suppose.
Yeah. And the pictures we did at the beginning were quite fun and amusing, vaguely. Mm. But I think it's interesting that sort of this documentary and also Amy are kind of looking at not just the highs of being a musician, they're actually looking about sort of the corruptibility of fame as well and celebrity, which I think is a really important theme at the moment. And this film, I think, really captures how fame and celebrity is a pressure cooker.
Yeah, at points in this film they say, oh, if Whitney was a pop star today, she would be dead. But also, the media wasn't quite as ferocious then as it is now. Yeah. So I wonder whether or not, the media attention on Amy and the reason that in that documentary there was so much to look at and of her destruction was because the press wouldn't leave her alone. And I wonder if the same thing was happening to Whitney now, would that be the case?
And it does another... I don't want to... comparing this with Amy, but this and Amy both do this. They don't have a voiceover narration.
Mm.
They don't have this kind of voice telling you what's going on. And I think that's important because, so as I mentioned, this seems like a film about what led to Whitney's death. And I think there's not one reason why a person dies. And the film, luckily, doesn't give one reason.
Well, it layers it, doesn't it?
Yeah, so it's like the breakup of the marriage. There's obviously the drug use. There's the fact that Robin left and all these different factors keying in.
The parents. There's so many.
There's so many things. But it doesn't pinpoint one, which I think is a nice touch because then you're left just having a complete picture of a person rather than just one aspect. Someone I'd like to talk about, actually, as well, is David Roberts, who was her bodyguard.
Oh,
amazing character.
Yeah, he comes across really really well in this.
Is he Welsh?
Yes, I think so. That's what I picked up.
Yeah,
he's not. Apologies.
Really incredible voice.
Yes.
And he's very much, oh yeah, I was the bodyguard.
he gives a great description during the about the film The Bodyguard.
Yeah.
And he says it's completely accurate apart from two things. One, the romantic relationship, and two, I've never been shot at. Which he said would make the film The Bodyguard quite dull.
Yeah. But he's really nice, really interesting. He's kind of the perfect person you want for a documentary. Mm.
But he's that fly on the wall.
Yeah.
He's that person that would see everything but isn't involved in everything. Yeah. And I think that's what's... So, and actually, when he does try and step in and tries to have more of an active role, not in terms of when he reports what's going on in her health and everything like that, that's the end. That's what gets him sacked. And actually, as soon as he steps away from being just a bodyguard out of the shadows, that's what ends up him leaving. And another sort of... He seems like a positive influence in he's concerned about health and everything like that. Suddenly another person is taken away and adds to those layers we were talking about of what brings down her demise. Someone else in her life, another structure of her life, it's just taken away.
Okay, so that is a Whitney Can I Be Me is out now. I think it's another one of those great documentaries where if you're not a Whitney Houston fan, I think you'll still really admire this film. There's a lot to be loved about it, and Nick Broomfield's a legend, so please go out and see it. So thanks again to CSR for letting us use their studio. So time for our Curzon Home Cinema recommendations this week. I'm going to go for La La Land, which we did talk about on the podcast when it first came out. Notoriously didn't win Best Picture, but I think there's a lot to love in La La Land. I think it's one of the most fun, enjoyable films that you could ask for. So do if you haven't seen it, or if you want to see it again, La La Land is now on Curzon Home Cinema.
I'm going to recommend Berlin Syndrome. It's on Curzon Home Cinema as well as in Curzon Cinemas themselves. Helen and I reviewed it on the podcast last week, so if you have a watch of it, you can go back and listen to that. It's well worth it.
And I'm going to recommend Prevenge. The main reason for this is Wonder Woman's out at the moment, which is obviously getting a lot of media attention because it's doing so well and because it has a female director. And so Alice Lowe directs Prevenge, and it's when her baby turns you into a killer. So a pregnant woman and her baby sort of turns her into a killer. It's really good fun.
Yeah.
Do watch it. So
excellent. Thanks for listening. Join us next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.